Why don't we go ahead and get started here? I think Brianna, serving as clerk, will be calling the roll.
Representative Bennett.
Here.
Representative Davidsmeyer.
Here.
Senator DeWitt.
Here.
Senator Kaler. Representative Harper. Representative Hernandez. Representative Moeller.
Here.
Senator Sims. Representative Sosnowski.
Here.
Senator Staines.
Here.
Senator Severson.
Here.
Senator Tracy.
All right, thank you. Please add Representative Harper to the roll. Welcome. And we have a number of new members. First, I'm very excited to get to work with Representative Davidsmeyer as the co-chair. Welcome. And I also want to welcome Representatives Bennett, Representative Harper, Representative Hernandez, and Representative Mueller, and Representative Sosnowski, as well as Senator DeWitt. So we have a lot of new folks joining COGFA. And I think we are going to take a little bit of time with the executive director here giving a little bit of an overview of what COGFA does for all of us. So you guys may have already heard and learned about that a little bit, but I think it's always good information. And with that, we will turn it over to our esteemed executive director who does a phenomenal job. Director Klenke, please. Clayton. And please add Senator Sims to the roll.
Thank you, Co-Chair Staines. Good morning, Co-Chair Staines, Co-Chair Davidsmeyer, and members of the commission. As Co-Chair Staines mentioned, my name is Clayton Klenke, and I am the Executive Director of the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. I wanted to welcome you all here today, particularly our new members. We have quite a few new faces on the commission. I believe I've worked with most of you in the past in one capacity or another, and I look forward to continuing to work with you in your role as a member of the commission. One thing I wanted to note is that this is the first meeting of our commission since the passage of Public Act 111-48, which was signed into law by the governor on December 10th, and that is the merger bill that combined LRU and the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability. So I just wanted to briefly mention that in addition now to using COGFA for your research requests that you've been used to in the past for things like revenue, economics, pensions, group insurance, we now have the component of the research unit with us that includes all nonpartisan research. Really not a topic I can think of that wouldn't be covered by that. If anything comes into your mind that you want some nonpartisan research on, I encourage you to reach out to our staff on that. So those were just my brief opening comments. Before we get into a review of our PowerPoint that we put together on the FY20 and FY19 revenue estimate, I did want to talk a little bit just about the state economic report that came out in February. That is the report that is included in your packet. That is a report that's done in conjunction with Moody's Analytics. And I just wanted to hit some of the main themes that are in that report before we get into more of the actual data that is contained in the PowerPoint. So looking at the 2019 report from Moody's, some of the top lines on that are the fact that Illinois' economy is considered to be in full employment right now, and we are moving into late cycle expansion. Basically, this phase is associated with labor supply constraints and an increase in wage and cost pressures. On net last year, about 70,000 jobs were added in Illinois, and manufacturing jobs accounted for about 25% of this new growth, so a good uptick on the manufacturing side in the last year. Now, Illinois has consistently trailed Midwestern states in employment and income growth since the Great Recession. This has been more pronounced on the employment side because on the actual income side, we are helped some by the fact that Illinois has a higher reliance on investment income than some other states in the nation. Illinois had a 5.5% employment growth in the last 5 years. That stood as about half of the national average. In the Midwest, the average was 6%, so we were closer to the Midwest average, but still trailing by about half the national average for employment growth. On the bright side, unemployment has essentially hit an all-time low. In the Moody's report, they mentioned that it's been a 42-year series they've tracked that, and we are at the lowest point in that series at the current time. One drawback to that is partially due to the fact that we have a stagnant labor force. So there is a question of how valuable that is as a variable to be used for economic forecasting. The Moody's report kind of takes two different approaches to looking at their forecast, a short-term approach and a long-term approach. And then they split each of those into a positive and negative category as to the factors that are associated with that forecast. So on the near-term outlook, Moody's forecasts that Illinois' economy will continue to grow over the next several quarters, although this growth will be short of the national and Midwest averages. They do forecast growth in the financial and professional sectors, and other sectors such as transportation and warehouse sectors will benefit from growth at the national level. They also see that there should be continued demand for Illinois goods. These positive factors are mitigated to some extent by some of the concerns that they voice. Chief among these concerns would be the general poor health of Illinois' state fiscal health. Even though we've had budgets the last 2 years, the bill backlog remains at roughly $8 billion. They do forecast that manufacturing payrolls will slow down in the coming year. The trade rift between U.S. and China complicates the export picture for Illinois. And, of course, our poor population trends serve to limit growth even when we have sectors that are doing well. This is especially true in the housing sector. In the long term, Moody's looks at the service-providing industries as an area for growth. This would be industries such as professional, business, and financial services, but also healthcare and education. Technology growth in the suburbs and Chicago shows that there's an area there for strong growth potential. And Illinois' labor force and the quality of our universities, the cash resources we have available for investments, and our transportation infrastructure all serve as positives for our long-term growth. These are, however, mitigated by the fact that our state's fiscal crisis impacts decisions by businesses on whether they want to relocate or stay in Illinois. Manufacturing has been a bright spot, but long-term trends forecast that it will be difficult to maintain the state's manufacturing base. The college-age population in Illinois and the Midwest is declining. This is true around the nation, but particular in Illinois, where we have fewer college-age students. Illinois has seen lower personal income growth than the nation, and this has led to underperformance in areas such as retail and hospitality. Some of the final emphasis in the report focuses on the population trends in Illinois. In recent years at the national and Midwest level, there has been some growth. In Illinois, however, we have had five consecutive years where population has actually decreased. Some of this is due to the national economy producing opportunities in other states for individuals. We see this in the fact that there's 85,000 less in annual migration among Illinois to other states or states to Illinois. So we're losing 85,000 residents just to other states every year. Previously, this was more to states like neighboring Indiana, but now we're seeing patterns more to Florida and Texas. Baby boomers are moving, but so are working age populations. And then finally, the fact that our birth rate is falling has impacted our population. Illinois used to have a natural birth rate growth of about 80,000 lives a year, and that in the last couple years has been about 38,000. So just a couple concluding remarks here. Overall, the economy has improved over the last year, as it generally has in the 10 years since the Great Recession. We've seen growth in many private sector industries, but current economic models would predict a slowdown in this growth is approaching. This gradual slowdown is not unique to Illinois and is based on national economic trends. The largest fiscal concerns remain the state's fiscal health and our population and demographic trends. The Moody's report has a baseline approach that would say that the highest risk for a recession would come in about mid-2020. So that is some of my just general overview of the Moody's report. I would also mention that the back half of the report includes the tables with all the data that leads to those findings. And then also the breakdown within the report includes more of a regional analysis, too, because Illinois is more of really a series of regional economies than it is one unified state economy. With that, I will just turn it over to Jim Machinsky, and he will go through the Illinois-specific data and our revenue forecast for the year.
Well, can we first pause and see if anyone has
sure.
any questions on the Moody's report? One of the things that what struck me was that it sounded like the demographics were connected to the state's fiscal problem in the way they were doing it. Do you know what they based that on? At least that's what it read to me. They were saying that, you know, all else, if it wasn't for the state's
right.
fiscal instability issues, that demographics would probably, you know.
Right. That was a specific finding they had
yeah.
in their report where they said that all else being equal, the population trend would tend to smooth out, but because of the ongoing fiscal health of the state, it continues to deteriorate.
And do you know what their basis for that is?
I think that was mainly just based on looking at the trends and looking at the type of individuals and where they were going. I'm not sure the exact methodology.
And do you know with what certainty they, you know, when they talk about the next recession being mid-2020, how do they assess that, and what's the risk that it might actually happen next fiscal year?
Sure, and I think Jim will get into that a little bit with his look at the baseline and optimistic and pessimistic approaches to where the economy is going. But a lot of that is just based on their forecasting models that show the percentage chance of how the economy should be performing over the next few months, and also the fact that that date for that has essentially been moved out over the last year or two, too. So if you would have looked at the data from a year or two ago, those dates would have been closer, and it's continued to push out some.
Senator Severson?
Thank you. A question on the out-migration issue. Do we track an idea of who makes up that out-migration, taxpayers, middle-class taxpayers? Is there a way to quantify by looking at modeling the tax returns of who's leaving?
And I know this is something we discussed with Moody's a little bit as the report was being put together to try to dial in on that a little bit. We don't have great information from them yet in regard to the age brackets or income brackets on who is leaving. Just more of that was based on where they were going at first. Other than to say that they say that it includes both individuals that are retiring and more now the working age families too.
Is there a way you could work with Department of Revenue to try to come up with an idea based on tax returns? If there's a way to quantify what kind of movement there have been by different income classes. And the other one that would be interesting to see about if there's any way to quantify any of the uber wealthy because of the issue with Illinois estate tax. Anecdotally, I know from our area certainly a large number of out-migration in the last few years, but is there a way to quantify those that may still work here, but they're, for the estate purposes, they're migrating out for their 6 months and a year, whatever it takes to become a resident in another state. But then obviously those individuals wouldn't be filing an Illinois, mm-hmm. probably an Illinois individual return. So if there's a way to quantify what kind of out-migration there's been on any of those real high-end earners as well, but if there's a way to kind of quantify that,
sure.
That
we will check to see if we can get some data that helps us in that regard.
Okay, and then and I haven't had a chance to look at it, but when you see was healthcare an area that there was a growth in jobs as well? I know you said manufacturing saw a good growth rate.
Yeah, they do mention some potential for growth in healthcare, especially with the aging population. they mentioned, you know, the age 65 and older is the only portion of the population that's actually growing, and in some regards that can be a good thing because of their use of medical services. It helps the economy. Of course, you know, there are other factors there, whether, you know, it helps the revenues in general for the state, but there has been some growth there. We have some other.
They mentioned in the report under healthcare, industry job growth will lag the U.S. average primarily because of Illinois' weaker population trends.
Okay.
So that'll likely be an underlying theme throughout most of the sector.
So that's one of the reasons why maybe there hasn't been as much healthcare growth, because when you have 50,000-80,000 less population, obviously you need less necessary healthcare delivery from that. That would make sense. So. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative Bennett, then Senator Sims.
Thank you. Clayton, if I may, toward the end of your comments, you mentioned something about the Illinois economy, and actually there's a number of economies, regional economies, et cetera. Could you maybe take for a moment, and what are we talking about? Are we talking 2, 3, Chicago, St. Louis? I mean, how do you... Well, yeah, what's your focus on?
I would, if you look into the provisions of the Moody's report, they actually take a little bit of a look at the Quad Cities.
Okay.
They look at Springfield and Champaign because of our reliance on state jobs, and then Chicago, the suburbs, and then downstate. You know, so really a series of different regions. Even though you may not think of Springfield and Champaign and Peoria as different regions, they highlight differences there. With Springfield and Champaign relying on state jobs, Peoria actually starting to show some numbers that are more concerning in terms of foreclosures. So even just, you know, cities within the central region showing differences.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, I'm interested, and Representative Bennett touched on this a little bit. You made a comment about the report looking at the state as a series of regional economies as opposed to one state economy. And I was interested in where those areas are. And there's a segment of the report that talks about business costs in particular. And it says that the state's longer-term outlook is tarnished primarily by its budget woes and weak population trends, not its high costs relative to nearby states. And the business costs in the state are lower than they are nationally and have trended downward for the past few decades. Then look at the overall index of relative business costs, and it looks like, as a comparison, we are doing very, very well. We have lower energy costs, we have a lower tax burden than many of our neighboring states, and the overall index seems to be we are very, very competitive. So I'm trying to figure out what those policies are. And you mentioned the next risk for a downturn or a recession will happen in 2020. How can we start recession-proofing our economy now?
Well, one of the things they mentioned, they have a stress test for state budgets that they do, too, and they view Illinois' budget with concern there in regard to things like money that's set aside for an emergency, the health of our pension systems, you know, the items that are going to cause us to be locked into expenditures regardless of how the economy is performing. You did mention, you know, the chart in there on the business costs show that in many of the areas that is a strength for us, especially energy, which at one point in time actually we had higher energy costs than the average, and that is lower now. So overall, that index is a strength for us.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you, Madam.
Please add Senator Tracy to the roll. Welcome. Okay, I think we're ready to move on to the, unless anyone else has a question, to the revenue forecast. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. It's nice to see some new faces on the commission. I know that we have a Senate appropriate hearing at 11 that a couple of the members need to go to. So I will try to condense a two-hour presentation into about 20 minutes so that you guys can make it. So I may be skipping over some pages or just highlighting some slides. I don't want to repeat some of Clayton's presentation, but we'll start on page 5, which looks at the national GDP. You can see that as we're approaching the 10-year anniversary of the recovery, That growth has been erratic over a quarterly basis, but has maintained positive over that period of time. The U.S. economy grew 2.9% in 18, which is up from 2.2% in 17 and 1.6% in 16. It is expected to fall to 2.5%. This is based on a aggregation of economic forecasts. It's expected to fall to 2.5% in 19 and 1.9% in 2020. So the consensus is not to have a recession in 2020, but the consensus is for a significant slowdown through the course of the forecast period. As we look on page 6, the Purchasing Managers Index, which is an indicator of economic health of the manufacturing sector. It's an index, so anything above 50 is considered expansion. Anything below that is contraction. And as you can see, through a couple of cycles since the recovery began, it's been fairly constant in between the 50 and 60 measure, with Chicago actually performing somewhat better than the nation. This is comprised of new orders, inventory levels, production, supplier deliveries, and the employment environment. Page 7 shows a much larger segment of the economy, the non-manufacturing index. Now, this comprises about 80% of the GDP, and it's comprised of things like wholesale, retail trade, transportation, warehousing, information, finance, real estate, science and tech, etc., those non-manufacturing industries. Because it's so much larger, the volatility isn't quite as great because you're dealing with larger segments of the economy. But again, it has shown considerable growth and consistency over the expansion phase of the economy. Page 8 shows the consumer price index for not only the U.S. but also Chicago. You know, there was a time back in September or so where there were some indications that inflation was going to start to take off. But it appears that those have dissipated, and we're seeing measures now returning below 2% in terms of overall CPI and just around 2% in terms of the core. That's on the top chart. In terms of Chicago, it's actually running slightly below the national level. So basically, inflation appears to be well in check, and that fear right now isn't anything that's knocking on the door. The producer price index is shown below on page 9. The PPI primarily measures goods, services, and construction products purchased by other producers as inputs, kind of like the first commercial transaction in the chain. And it also had a period there back in the summer where we were over at 6% on the PPI. While not a super strong correlation with the regular CPI, there's always the connotation that as the front end of the chain, as costs increase, so too will the back end to the consumer. But that also has cooled considerably, running only about 1% with the last data point. Page 10 shows a 10-year Treasury rate. We had got as high as 3.25% in the near term, going back to November of 18, but that has also quickly cooled down to just over 2.6. The decline likely caused by the concerns of a weakening global economy. Clayton had mentioned exports. That's on page 11. These are monthly Illinois exports, and you can see we kind of bottomed out there in 2016 or thereabouts, but have since then trended up. Now, of course, the trade conflict between China is of course a potential drag on us, since China is our third highest importer of Illinois goods. Page 12 shows the Illinois manufacturing employment data. And here's one where you actually see some near-term improvement. I think Clayton had mentioned this when he talked about manufacturing numbers. You can see that over the last year or so, we've had a decidedly strong upturn there in the manufacturing employment figures. Since December of 2018, We had gained 36,700 jobs going back to 2009. But clearly, as you look where we were back in 07, we're still well below those pre-recession levels. You know, uncertain we'll ever hit those marks again. A few slides on employment. Page 13 and 14 and 15, but page 13 is a national employment chart, and it shows that since the recovery began, it took about 5 years for the nation to recover the jobs lost during the recession, both in the household survey as well as the establishment, or sometimes it's called the payroll survey. But when we look to Illinois, which is on page 14 under those same surveys and under the same measures, while the establishment survey also recouped the jobs, it did so about 3 years after the nation as a whole. Whereas under the household survey, while we've seen some improvement, we've yet to recover the jobs lost during the recession. The unemployment rates are shown on page 15. Most of you are probably aware of this, but Illinois tends to run a little bit higher than the nation as a whole. But what you may see is we tend to fare worse during times of downturn and then are a little slower to improve during the expansion period. And I think this chart on page 15 is kind of indicative of that. You can see during the recession's largest impact, our unemployment rate was considerably higher than that of the nation. And while our rate also fell during the recovery phase, it did so at lower levels. However, now that we're around 4% or so, as Clayton mentioned, essentially full employment, we've synced back up, and we're very close to the nation as a whole. Page 16 shows the same measures, although in a slightly different presentation on a bar graph, and we include the Midwest in here. They're in red. If we go back to 2008, you'll see that we were synced up pretty well with the nation as well as the Midwest. But then during the course of the largest impact of the recession, as well as over the recovery period, there was a divergence between us and our neighbors, as well as the nation. But again, 2018, you can see that we've kind of resynced again and differ only by a few tenths of a percent. Well, up until now, we've basically talked about current economic measures, and we turn now to discussing future expectations over the forecast period. IHS Market is one of our econometric firms that we subscribe to, and on page 17, you'll see that they offer us three different scenarios for the upcoming 24 months or so. There's a baseline forecast, which is given a value of a 60% probability. It's their control forecast or their most likely forecast, and it would have the GDP slowing to just over 1% by the end of 2019, and to 1.8% in 2020. So still growth, but slower due to fading fiscal stimulus, tightening monetary policy, and the approach to capacity constraints. A 25% probability of occurrence is that of the pessimistic scenario. It would have growth slipping to 1.7% by the end of 19, and then the GDP actually contracting 1.5% in 2020. So they would have a recession running from the first quarter of 2020 to the third quarter of 2020. So that would encapsulate part of fiscal year 20 and then well into fiscal year 2021. A final optimistic scenario, but it's given just a 15% chance of occurrence, would have growth remain around the 2.9% rate over the forecast period, and then about a percent higher than the baseline in the 2020 out year. Page 18 just provides some discussions of those values that they associate with the scenarios. And then on page 19 shows the baseline forecast of the values associated with a historical look, as well as going out through 2020. You can see 3% for 18 falling to 1.8% for 2020. Personal consumption at the bottom, these are on current dollar basis. It's pretty consistent, but falls to 4.2%. And the unemployment rate is also maintained pretty well at 3.6%. Illinois specifically is on page 20. Again, we would be expected to decline from 2.9% to just under 1% over the forecast period, but our unemployment rate would also maintain pretty decent, around 4.2 to 4.3%. The chart on page 21 is illustrative that things right now in Illinois are doing pretty well. From an employment level, we're up almost 1% for the actual number of workers. And in terms of the wage pressures, we're seeing gains in the wages of about 3.7%, indicative of where we are in the recovery. So the 4.6% aggregate of those two measures is more than double what we've seen over the last couple of years, and you have to go back to 2012 before you see those measures that high. So this is probably one reason why we're seeing, and we'll get into this in just a second, income taxes performing quite well. More people are working, and they're earning more as well, so that's going to generate some income tax flow. So that's it from the economic side. Let's turn our attention now to the actual numbers, to the revenue forecasts. Page 23 just shows you where we're coming from. The 19 estimate was based on revenues estimated to be $38.52 billion. And there's a breakout there in that pie chart, but the table on page 24 shows it numerically as well. A couple of major assumptions were used when the budget was crafted. The first is that we included $300 million, I shouldn't say we, the budget, the state's budget, as passed, assumed $300 million for the sale of the Thompson Center. Well, as we'll see in a little bit, that's being removed from... What are you chuckling about over there? Okay. And then also... The budget was predicated on $800 million in interfund borrowing, and we will see in a minute that that also has failed to materialize. But in total, the budget was forecast to be based on $38.52 billion. So that was then, this is now. Page 25 shows on a month-over-month basis how revenues have performed relative to the same month of the previous year. We provide this comparison both with federal sources and without federal sources. The reason being, federal sources can make wild swings in monthly revenue performance. And you can see in November, we fell over $1.7 billion due to the bond sale proceeds, which occurred in the fall of 2017, that generated a lot of federal spending and federal match. That did not repeat this year, so there's a big fall off. So I would say you want to look at here that general funds without federal sources through the first two-thirds of the fiscal year have grown just over $1 billion, $1.049 billion. A more refined breakout is shown on the following page in the table on page 26. I'll just highlight some of the major revenue sources. The closely tied economic sources continue to demonstrate considerable strength. If you look at the top three lines there, personal income tax is up 4.6% on a gross basis, corporate income tax up over 14%, and sales taxes are running just under 7%. Some pretty good measures. Some of the lesser revenue sources have also returned some good gains. Estate tax is up over 16%. Corporate franchise over 19, and interest income has actually doubled due to the higher rates in comparison with the previous year, and that's generated $42 million in gains. But it's not until you get down to midway through the page here, and you'll see federal sources are actually down $2.5 billion. So obviously that has a large impact on the year-over-year total. The fall off in federal sources is not a surprise. It's a surprise to the magnitude it's occurred, but we knew going into this fiscal year that federal sources were going to be lower. So, taking into account year-to-date performance of the first two-thirds of the year, as well as updating our expectations over the remainder of the fiscal year, the Commission's fiscal year 19 general funds estimate is now $38.336 billion. We include a little narrative in terms of where and how much of the increases have occurred. Just briefly, net income taxes are being revised up $450 million, just based on year-to-date performance that's outperformed relative to earlier expectations. Sales tax, in a similar vein, has done a little bit better than we had expected. Other state sources in total is being revised down $242 million. This is where the removal of the J.R. Thompson Center, the value of $300 million, comes into play. The downward revisions isn't quite that high because there's some upward movement in some of the lesser revenue lines. Transfers in is also being revised up $109 million. This is due to the budget as passed only assumed $200 million in transfers from the income tax refund fund. In actuality, $327 million was available for such transfer, so there's a upward movement in the estimate there. But it's in federal sources where you see most of those increases reversed. The forecast now stands at 3.050, which is $735 million less than the budget has passed. As we'll see in a little bit, the Governor's Office of Management and Budget has also made some significant downward revisions there as well. Federal sources is dependent upon appropriation levels, cash available for spending, and then ultimately the spending that takes place at the comptrollers. So those things, when they fall short of expectations, impact on your federal receipts.
I just want to pause for a second. Illinois Times is requesting leave for taking photos, seeing no objections. Leave is granted, and please add Senator Kaler to the roll.
And then I had mentioned earlier that $800 million in interfund borrowing is part of the original budget assumptions. Unfortunately, only $250 million of actual interfund borrowing has taken place and will take place. The comptrollers indicated the shortage there was due to lack of liquidity in available funds. So there's a $550 million differential from the budget as passed. However, when the budget was passed, there was not a value assigned to the Treasurer's Investment Borrowing Initiative, which was signed into law at the end of August. Since that time, the state has executed $700 million using those monies from current expenditures that are using monies not needed for current expenditures and instead invested by the Treasurer's Office to pay down the long-standing liabilities, which were incurring those high timely payment and prompt payment fee interest penalties. Most of that borrowing will be repaid by May, but it will potentially cause some cash flow difficulties for the comptroller. So again, some pressure in terms of the federal source estimate I'm going back to. So that's it for fiscal year 2019. In total, with the revisions, it falls $184 million below the budgeted level back in June, which is a 0.4% differential. How does our estimate now stack up with that of GOMB's released a couple of weeks ago in the budget book? Well, it's quite similar. The table on page 29 shows that in total, our forecast stands just $24 million different from the Bureau, with ours being just slightly below. Now, while in total, things are essentially the same, there are some component differences. Income taxes were slightly higher in our forecast for both personal and corporate income taxes, as is our outlook for sales taxes. All other state sources are very close, differing only by $14 million. But we're a little less optimistic in our view of transfers in. And federal sources, even with our big downward revision, it may be difficult even to hit our number, much less GOMB's higher number, which is $170 million above our revised forecast. But overall, the estimates are very, very close for fiscal year 19. Page 30 simply shows a more refined difference between our estimate and their estimate. There's, again, everything totals to the $24 million overall. So let's get right to the 2020 revenue forecast. This is on page 31, and we put together our forecast based on current law. So our forecast is $38.186 billion. The projection represents growth of $800 million in base revenues, but it does fall $150 million overall once the interfund borrowing and the Treasurer's investment borrowing are included in the revenue comparison. In terms of the underlying economic assumptions used to craft the budget, We, along with the Bureau, as well as the other economic consensus forecasts that you've heard explained today, we're assuming that there'll be a slowdown or a moderation in growth over the forecast period for such things as personal income tax, corporate income tax, and even sales. We're not assuming that a recession will actually impact on these revenues, but we are assuming that the current rates of growth will moderate over the forecast period. Nonetheless, income taxes are expected to grow $445 million overall. Net sales tax is up $194 million. All other state sources are expected to fall off, in large part due to the refund transfer that occurred this year that will be far less in fiscal year 20. The transfers in line reflects the fall off from the income tax refund fund occurring or not occurring. And the federal source line, right now we're adopting the same federal source estimate that's being carried by GOMB. Ultimately, appropriation levels, cash flow spending availability, as well as the spending on reimbursable bills such as Medicaid kind of dictates that number. But as of right now, we are utilizing the same $3.5 billion+ estimate for federal sources. Interfund borrowing right now is not included in the forecast. The statutory deadline has passed for that for this fiscal year. That was March 1st. And while the Treasurer's investment borrowing can theoretically extend as long as you don't exceed $2 billion of outstanding borrowing, no amounts are currently assumed, or at least we have not been apprised of any future Treasurer's investment borrowing. So in total then, on page 32, a more refined breakout adds to the estimate of 38.186 for fiscal year 2020. We wanted to at least give you an idea how our forecast stacks up to that of the GOMB's estimate released at the end of February. So we've included this table on page 33. Comparing our forecast and GOMB's estimate presents somewhat of a challenge. Included in most of their tables are a number of initiatives that the governor has proposed. So when we look at our current law estimate of 38.186 and compare it to their overall estimate as presented in most of their tables of 38.903, our forecast is lower by $717 million. But in an attempt to offer a more meaningful comparison, since that's kind of apples and oranges, what we've done is we've adjusted GOMB's estimate to current law levels based in most cases on information that they provided in the budget book. So in doing so, the estimates close much of that gap, and this is in that yellow shaded section of the table. We close much of the gap, and then we differ by only $81 million, or about 0.2%, with the Commission's forecast being the lower of the two. Essentially, we're removing from the GOMB's forecast approximately $636 million of associated initiatives. The following two pages essentially rack up each of those reductions, and you can see, I won't go through all of them, but net income taxes is where you would see the decoupling from the federal repatriation credit and the phase out of the private school scholarships and so on and so forth. I will mention that it's a bit under the radar, but the governor's proposed revenue forecast assumes the continuation of the 5% retention of the LGDF funds, as well as this 5% retention of some of the sales tax money that goes to some of the transit funds. The value of those things combined is about $100 million. Also included in his in the net downward adjustments would be the cigarette tax. While the overall impact of raising the cigarette taxes, the e-cigarettes, as well as tobacco products is expected to be a net increase in those related revenues, the governor would propose changing the distribution of cigarette taxes. It actually reduces monies to the GRF. They instead go to the to the healthcare provider fund. So we try to make those adjustments as well. So again, overall, when you kind of glean away those impacts of those initiatives, the underlying economic forecasts, I believe, are quite similar between us and GOMB. That is continued growth, albeit at a more modest level. Going forward, I think the downside risk, while some in fiscal year 2020, I think looking forward into fiscal year 2021 would be where we may see a significant downturn in revenues, or revenue growth at least. But that's, we'll discuss that next year. So that's what I have for you today.
All right, thank you. Questions? Representative Sosnowski?
Sorry, refresh my memory. I think I heard you right. I just wanted to make sure. And the treasurer's investment borrowing, that's one-time cash infusion. Did you say the payback out is this May, coming up just a couple months?
I believe the comptroller, and I don't remember the specific dollar values, but it was over $600 million of that $700 will be repaid by May.
Okay, so that just hurt us on the spend side. And then why don't you think we should account for any of that for next year? Is that just their initial indication that they won't have
it's,
any?
It's
just unknown.
It's just unknown.
Okay.
It's just unknown.
Okay. Thanks. That was it.
Senator DeWitt?
Thank you, Chairman. A quick question. The $170 million of federal funding that did not come through, was that attributed to any particular fund within the state budget, or
the $170 million? I believe you're referencing is the differential.
I'm looking at page 29.
Right, it's the differential between our forecast and the Governor's Office of Management and Budget's forecast for federal sources.
Okay,
that's all that is. We're more conservative. When you take a look at federal sources year to date, coupled with historically what we've been able to generate between March and June, we will be hard-pressed to even hit our number, but we think it's a possibility. But that 170 is just a differential between our forecasts.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So when we look at the manufacturing employment, do we have any idea how much of this is going over state lines as opposed to going overseas? Do we track where we're losing these jobs to, or if they're just generally closing manufacturing?
You know, actually, no, we don't know.
Okay.
That. But in terms of looking at sector employment and changes historically as well as more recent activity, just released this morning is the Commission's February monthly revenue briefing. Yeah. And in there's a nice three-page discussion of long-term trends, which saw the higher wage sectors eroding, but the lower wage sectors increasing. But what we saw just in the last year or so, there's been considerable strengthening in the higher wage sectors like manufacturing and construction. So that's kind of a shift, a very recent shift.
Okay. So positive trend that direction, which is good.
Short term.
Short term.
Okay. Short term. Yeah.
Let's see. When we look at the unemployment rate, how much of our decreased unemployment is affected by people leaving the state, no longer being counted as part of that? And I assume people leaving probably are generally employable, going to somewhere else. But are they leaving because, I guess you can't infer why they're leaving, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question now. Okay. We've kind of been chasing that for a couple of years. That question's been asked. We just don't know. I will say, and I think it's in the Moody's report somewhere, that the participation rate is very close to that of the Midwest, around 65%, and actually higher than the U.S. rate of 62.9%. So from that standpoint, Illinois really isn't much different than our surrounding, our neighboring states.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Thank you.
You have a number of new revenue, well, the governor's proposed budget included a number of new revenue items, that, you know, e-tax on taxing on e-cigarettes, sports wagering, recreational cannabis revenue, plastic bag tax, a delinquent tax payment incentive program, and MCO assessment. Have you guys taken a look at what their estimates were for these items and done your own analysis about what you think, if that does get passed, whether these are good estimates or not?
Well, we've yet to see anything in statute, so it's hard to, you know, just based on little paragraphs in the budget book, and so it's difficult. You know, in terms of the sports wagering and in terms of the cannabis, the way it's explained is that's not all you're doing in order to get that money within fiscal year 2020 is selling licenses and then crediting those sales forward 5 years to the purchasers of those licenses. And I don't think there's been any flushing out of the details on that. In terms of phasing out of the private school scholarships of $6 million, I think that's probably based on actual participation in the program, and I wouldn't argue that amount. The decoupling from the federal repatriation credit, that's a Department of Revenue through their auditing process, would likely come up with that figure. We'll take a look at the plastic bag tax, but again, we haven't yet seen any concrete proposals. The real estate transfer tax distribution change, that's a one-year thing. That's under the other source adjustment that we made. And that's simply a distribution change. So nothing really jumps out at us as being erroneous. Now, of course, we're not experts in the managed care organization assessment plan that he's proposed. That's a large amount, $390 million. But I didn't want to get too much into the weeds here, but of the $1.121 billion in publicized revenue initiatives, what that really represents is benefits to general revenue. And it's comprised of three buckets. One is actual receipts into general revenue. That's about $577 million of that $1.121 billion. And then you have another $455 million related to the managed care organization assessment and the cigarette changes in the cigarette taxes and e-cigarettes. That money will go into the provider relief fund for Medicaid payments, but in doing so, it then frees up pressure on general revenue. So those are two of the largest buckets of that $1.121 billion. And then finally, there's a small $89 million component related to a change in how the video gaming tax structure would operate. Video gaming money doesn't go to general revenue. It goes into the capital projects fund. But if that were to go into the capital projects fund, again, it alleviates general funds backfill pressure for debt service. So the $1.121 billion must be viewed as in general funds benefit. It's a more of a macro look at the impact of these initiatives, not specific to general funds revenue, which is what we do when we do our forecast. So we try to break that out in the document.
Great. Thank you. Representative Mueller?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Thank you for your presentations. Just a couple small detailed questions. When you're looking at the revenue estimates and what we're going to be bringing in terms of income tax and potential sales tax, did you include the change to the minimum wage as a factor that might influence? And I realize that it won't take effect until the first phase won't take effect until January 1st, and the second phase until July 1st of next year. But was there any economic impact that was taken into consideration when putting these numbers together?
Not over this forecast horizon.
Okay.
That would be something perhaps in the out years might have to be accounted for, but not within we didn't feel comfortable including anything in there. I understand, based on testimony by the Director of Revenue last week, they put in $20 million, mm-hmm. I believe. $20 million on the base of what our income taxes are, it's hardly a, you know, it's like a tenth of 1% difference.
Sure.
So we just didn't feel compelled to do that.
Okay.
Looking forward then over the next couple of years, it'll be difficult to isolate what, if any, impacts are associated with that minimum wage increase, because as we said, that may be about the same time where a global or national slowdown may mm-hmm. be happening as well. But what we'll do is probably take a look closely at the sector wage earnings, and of course those sectors who are most likely of the minimum wage variety, you know, your hospitality, that type of thing. Perhaps we'll be able to dispel some or distill some trends going forward, but it's nothing that we felt comfortable with including in today's presentation.
Gotcha. Is there any impact that the tax cut or the change in tax policy at the federal level that it had on our revenues? I know that it affected the ability for homeowners to exempt a certain amount of property taxes on their federal income tax. But is there any other impact that either positive or negative that affects our revenues here in the state?
We had some timing issues last year. But by and large, those kind of worked themselves out. That question was specifically asked to Moody's when we talked to them about doing the report again. And their response is that Illinois really was minimally impacted by the federal changes. In terms of other states, had a bigger impact to them than what happened in Illinois. So it wasn't that big of a deal for us.
Interesting. Okay. And then on your motor fuel tax, the historical and estimated, it seems to hold pretty constant through 2011 to our estimate in 2020. With a change away from combustion engines to electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles, is there any? What are you seeing in terms of projected revenues long term? I know that's one area that we've talked about changing or looking at as far as sustainability of funding our transportation and infrastructure.
Right. Well, I think the table on page 37 essentially speaks for itself. I mean, you can go back to 2011, motor fuel taxes brought in 1.347, and here we are. 10 years later, looking at 1.372. So
yeah.
It's essentially flat.
Okay. That shows some indication that the electric vehicle supply is affecting. You would expect that to increase over time, although our population is also.
I think what you're seeing here is flat. A stagnation from all factors combined.
Mm-hmm.
If there's pluses on one side, they're being offset by minuses on the other. So overall, it's very flat. That's kind of an easy one to forecast because there's really very little change there.
Okay. And then finally, when it comes to the Moody's, their economic forecast, it seems to me that the two largest factors that are affecting our ability to improve our economic condition here in the state is, one, the budget of the state of Illinois and our ability to fund the programs and services that we offer as a state, including our pensions and our long-term liabilities, and the population decline that we've seen over the last few years. When it comes to improving the financial stability of the state, where are they in terms of the approach that they would recommend the state pursue?
They really don't offer up solutions other than commentary in regards to maybe providing consistency. That's one thing that businesses hate is not knowing, uncertainty. And to whatever level that the state can offer up a consistent view to businesses, you know, businesses are pretty adaptable. You can do a lot if you know what to expect. And I think what's hurt us over the last few years is that uncertainty. So if we can point to a direction and kind of stay the course and show, say, Moody's, for example, mm-hmm. that we have a plan, I think that would go a long way in terms of assuaging their criticisms of Illinois.
So consistency is more of a priority than, say, reducing taxation or other, you know, we hear a lot in the policy debate that if we change our tax structure, that will affect our economic growth because it'll be bad for business or it'll be unattractive to businesses coming into the state or leaving the state.
Yeah,
you're saying that consistency and stability is more of a factor.
I think that they certainly weigh those things, consistency, as a large component in terms of overall stabilizing the state's finances.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Senator Severson?
Thanks. Couple questions. One, an earlier one, we were talking about the impact on some of the trade issues that may or may not happen once they stabilize some of those. But more locally on the NAFTA trade issues between Canada, Mexico, and with the agricultural side, which obviously has a big bearing on Illinois. Did that agreement get worked out? And are we forecasting any? My understanding is the farm people are pretty happy about that new agreement.
We haven't gotten into specifics of that.
We can look into that.
But nothing has been quantified in the forecast per se.
Okay.
But we can look into that.
I'm not even sure that trade deal. I should probably know that. Did that trade got completed or finalized on the NAFTA part of it, as opposed to obviously some of the other.
We can look into that.
National ones. Then you had mentioned that there was good. A good growth with the manufacturing and construction, or so with the average wages actually doing a little bit better. So higher end incomes were going up a little bit more, which is a positive thing that's occurred. Do we ever look at what the impact is of what the ripple effect is on, like, manufacturing and construction, where those dollars get churned? Obviously, multiple times more so than retail, which just that dollar gets churned one time and then goes out. But
type of dynamic modeling that universities are famous for doing. Our forecasts are primarily based on static modeling that takes a look at what actually is occurring and trending that forward based on observations. So that's nothing that we would have. Really
no, and what the impact would be if manufacturing were to slow down, general impact would
then capture that in the trends that we see in the other revenue sources associated with changes in say the employment levels.
Okay, and then you talk about how we've had you're forecasting still continued growth in. At this point, in manufacturing and in construction, for this coming year, so we don't see a point where it's going to be flat or negative, but still trending potentially upwards in those two areas.
It's not that we forecast each individual sector. What I said was the long-term trend, which had been decidedly negatives for those higher-paying sectors, have undergone a recent uptick. So we saw that in the monthly. If you were to look at the February monthly briefing, you'll see that over the last year, from 17 to 18, we've seen a nice uptick in those higher paying sectors. One year doesn't a trend make, but it's certainly nice to see a reversal of what had been about a decade's worth of decline. So when we forecast, we have to forecast more from a macro standpoint. I mean, we just don't have the resources that, say, a Department of Revenue would have in terms of looking at actual returns. So our view is more of a macro approach. And from that standpoint, we're incorporating kind of the consensus forecast of a slowdown in underlying economic activity, So we would see, for example, in the case of personal income tax, a slowdown to approximately 2.5% for 2020, which would be about half of what we're seeing in 19, which is about 3.9. And then for corporate income tax, growth of only about 2%, which is down from over 8%, which we're seeing this fiscal year. So those are the valuations that we would assign for what does a slowdown look like in terms of actual state revenue growth.
A couple years ago, we'd be excited about those numbers.
Exactly.
We wouldn't be talking about that as a slowdown. We'd be excited.
Right.
So
right. There's no doubt that right now things are pretty good. And unfortunately, it's probably going to be about as good as it's going to get. If we were to maintain this as long as we can, that would be great. But at some point, things are probably going to take a downside turn. The question is, when will that happen? And if I could answer that, quite frankly, I'd probably be on Wall Street somewhere. But
right.
There certainly is the view that's pretty global in nature that there is going to be a slowdown coming, whether it's 6 months, a month, 2 years from now.
Yeah, I guess maybe it's terminology, because what you call a slowdown, we really call as a more normality, or it would be something we would be happy with.
Exactly.
We shouldn't get depressed that we've had this really abnormal peak time, but we're still going back, and if we're positive as opposed to being negative, positive numbers are still something that we should be celebrating.
Yes, we're just a little less positive than what we're currently experiencing.
Great.
So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Kaler?
I guess it makes me wonder about what the effects of a capital bill will have on this, because right now we're in a slow time for construction, certainly. And what happens if we have an influx of billions of dollars in terms of improving our roads and infrastructure? Has that been thought about at all in terms of any projections?
Well, if you can show me the capital plan, I'll be happy to. Capital bill, I'll be happy to. I mean,
we're all waiting for that.
Yeah, no, nothing like that has been in anticipated or included in here. I mean, obviously, any type of a large scale capital plan would be a boost to Illinois' economy. But again, you don't just flip a switch. Mm-hmm. After the passage of a bill, it takes time for those projects to actually ramp up and go through the process. In most cases, many years. So,
just thinking back in terms of when we did the last capital bill in 2009, did that help sustain some of our economy in the next following years after that? Just for your recollection?
I don't recollect, and it would be really hard to distill from the data the impact of anything like that may have. I mean, clearly, large-scale capital projects tend to have a boost. They don't occur overnight. It takes some time for them to happen, so there is kind of a long-term impact associated with them. But to your question, well, when they're over, what does that mean? I can't sit here and answer that question today.
Thanks.
Really quick, just going back to the federal funds that you're looking at, the $735 million difference between the enacted and the COGFA budget. It looks like in 2020 you're expecting the majority of that to return. That you said that was based on bond sales, some kind of bond?
No, that's simply based on the information provided in the budget book, which is based on proposed spending levels for Medicaid reimbursements. That's the only thing we're basing that number on. For us to assume a number dramatically different from that's being proposed by the governor connotates that we know something that they don't, and we don't.
Okay.
All of those things get flushed out during the course of the appropriation process. The ultimate appropriation for Medicaid spending will then dictate what the federal source number actually is expected to be.
So currently, the 2020 number that looks like it gets an extra,
There's growth there of about 500 or so million.
$500 million. Is that, do you know if that's based on an expectation that there will be more Medicaid spending and more federal reimbursement, or do we know where that expectation is?
It would be based upon the expectation of reimbursable spending for general funds. Yes.
Okay, just general reimbursement.
Yes.
Okay.
About 90% of that federal source line is comprised of Medicaid reimbursements.
Okay, so as we look at increased reimbursements, we're also looking at increased spending on the on the other side,
you have to
which
get,
isn't your...
You have to get the one before
exactly.
the other.
Exactly. So. All right, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Thank you. Terrific presentations. Really appreciate your help and work
sure.
today. All right, with that, we will adjourn cockpit.